Thank you. Good morning, everyone. First case of the day. Appeal 093558, United States versus Johnson. Good morning, Mr. Holmes.
Good morning, John. May it please the court.
Good morning.
Your Honor, defendant appellant Wendell Johnson was indicted May 17, 2009 for two counts of distribution of cocaine base. Mr. Johnson went to trial and was convicted, found guilty by a jury on June 10, 2009, and he was sentenced in the Southern District of Illinois by the Honorable Judge Steele on October 14, 2009. There were two cells controlled by us in this case. They were videotaped. The evidence at trial showed that the videotape did not show the actual exchange or hand-to-hand transaction with the confidential informant and the defendant. During the trial, there were several pieces of 404B related evidence that were introduced that Mr. Johnson feels persuaded unfairly and improperly persuaded the jury to convict based on propensity evidence. The evidence that was introduced, and let me first, the trial attorney failed to object to the introduction of a lot of this evidence, so the standard of review is plain error in many of these instances. But the evidence that we're challenging that was admitted, Your Honor, deals with prior drug sales or alleged drug transactions by defendant Mr. Johnson. The informant testified at trial that Mr. Johnson had sold him cocaine base 15 times prior, Your Honor. It was not related to the charge. It wasn't intrinsically intertwined with the government's case.
Well, Mr. Holmes, here's the problem, I guess. Even if one or more of the evidentiary decisions were erroneous, how would they be a basis of reversal where the properly admitted evidence of guilt seems to be so significant? You know, we have a number of control buys where the informant meets with Johnson alone, emerges without the money, and with crack cocaine. So how would we be able to hold that a jury would probably have acquitted when that evidence was before it?
Your Honor, the argument, well, our position is that the propensity evidence distracted the jury from the actual evidence that was at issue at the trial, and that was the evidence of the tape, which did not show a actual transaction between the defendant and the confidential informant, and the a close inspection of the credibility of the confidential informant. The confidential informant was an admitted crack cocaine user. He admitted at trial that he was still using crack cocaine when he was doing these control buys for law enforcement. He was paid each time he did a control buy or made a purchase, Your Honor, and the issue before the jury and the argument that was made by Mr. Johnson's trial attorney was that the confidential informant had the motive opportunity to set up as many people as possible to get paid for these to support his drug habit.
But that may be so, but you know, he purchased drugs from Mr. Johnson and was then, you know, searched. Well, the informant was searched before and after the transactions. Doesn't that make it virtually impossible for anyone else to have been the source of the drugs?
Well, Your Honor, for an outside person, yes, but the argument that was presented at trial was that this confidential informant, who was well-versed with crack cocaine, had the ability and the knowledge and the wherewithal to secret it's one small rock at a time, to secret this, to keep law enforcement from finding it.
And counsel, wouldn't that be more reason, as the government seemed to suggest during this trial, that this was something that his knowledge of this transaction, his participation in it, was not true, and therefore these other instances in which the government produced were developed to rebut that contention by the defense in the case.
Yes, Your Honor. If the defense was knowledge, intent, lack of mistake, but that's not the defense that was raised. The government claims that the defense put its knowledge at issue by simply saying he didn't do it. Now, one of the things that the tapes show is the confidential informant talking to Mr. Johnson and showing him what he called a gizmo. A gizmo is a crack pipe. Mr. Johnson says, "I don't mess with that," and that's on tape. That wasn't something that the defense made up. That itself, if you're shown a crack pipe, if you don't know what crack is, you say, "I don't know what that is." You know, he says he doesn't mess with that. He knows it's crack cocaine. The issue of knowledge was not put at issue. Mr. Johnson not once claimed that he did not know what crack cocaine is. He did not once claim that it was a mistake. What I thought I was selling him was, or giving to him, was something besides crack cocaine. Those issues were not raised in the defense. The argument was simply that Mr. Johnson did not sell these items to the informant, and the informant set him up by having them on his person and claiming that there was a controlled buy. So
that issue is more focused, I think, on the 2007 drug conviction, wasn't it? I mean, what you're saying, that was totally focused on, only reason for allowing that in was knowledge. Is that your position?
And well,
because it seems to me that's maybe the closer question in this case, is the prior conviction, and for the reason it came in is something other than propensity.
Well, it does go to knowledge in that case, and I believe
Do you say it does?
The prior conviction, the government argues that it goes to knowledge.
So I'm saying, what's your position?
My position, it does not go to knowledge, because knowledge is not an issue in this case. The 404B evidence should only be admitted if knowledge is at issue in the case, and knowledge was not at issue in this case, Your Honor. And
of course, a limiting instruction was provided.
Yes, a limiting instruction was provided, Your Honor, but it's the position of the defense that if you look at each one of these instances that we bring up by themselves, it's relatively straightforward, and you could find that it was harmless error and so forth. But if you look at what the evidence was at trial and all of this evidence presented as a whole, in totality, you have a videotape that did not show a transaction, a defense argument saying that the confidential informant had the means and opportunity to set up the defendant, and that's the question for the jury. That's the issue that's at trial. That's the issue that's charged in the indictment. Then you cloud the jury with the fact that the informant says, "Well, he sold to me 15 times before." The police officer says that, "Well, we knew him from prior police conduct, and when the informant came in, we showed him a booking photo." When you look at the testimony of his brother, and this is one that I really see no basis for, his brother comes in and testifies that, "I ran out of dope the day before, so I went and got some dope from my brother the day before the transaction."
See, the mountain that you've got to climb here is Johnson's defense was certainly in part that he was engaged in transactions involving guns, not drugs. And, you know, with this informant. And, you know, he's not involved in crack cocaine. He's not dealing that kind of stuff. So the prior transactions were relevant to demonstrate knowledge and to, you know, clarify for the jury the circumstances of the charged offense. You know.
Well, Your Honor, if I may, the argument about conversations pertaining to guns, that was confirmed by the confidential informant. This isn't a situation where it's just one side say, indicating.
No, I said in part.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry. I misheard you, Your Honor. I'm going into my rebuttal time, and I would like to.
I should have reminded you. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Boyce.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Mr. Holmes. My name is Don Boyce. I'm here on behalf of the government this morning. This case involved two controlled buys of crack cocaine from Johnson to an informant. They were recorded, done under police surveillance. The evidence at trial consisted primarily of putting on the evidence of those controlled buys. It was recordings of the preparatory calls where the informant called up Johnson and ordered the dope, evidence of the way the controlled buys are conducted, being strip searched ahead of time, wired up, evidence of the surveillance. The recordings themselves were played. The recordings don't show the hand-to-hand transaction, but they do show Johnson's face. They show that nobody else was there, and they show the crack cocaine. And the crack itself was admitted. So I would submit that that evidence to the charged offenses was substantial. On appeal, Johnson, I would submit, has gone through the transcript and plucked out a few small pieces from the transcript that had little to do with what was really going on at trial, and is trying to argue that the government tried to convict Johnson based on his propensity to sell crack rather than on this other evidence, which was much more substantial.
Yeah.
What about the prior conviction? That's the only thing I look at is something that apparently the reason is brought in to show knowledge. Is there some other of the exceptions that would apply for bringing that in?
No, Your Honor. Knowledge was the exception. And the way I presented that to the district court and the way I presented it to the jury is the same thing I'll say now. The elements of the charged offense were that the defendant knowingly distributed crack cocaine and that he knew that the crack cocaine was a controlled substance. So knowledge is in both of those. The one that I focused on more, though, was the second element, knowledge that crack cocaine is a controlled substance.
Was there some question about that?
Well, the way I pose the argument, Your Honor, is that it's an element of the offense. Whether or not the defendant says, I don't know that crack is a controlled substance, it's still something that we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So the argument, as I posed it, was, well, to the extent that Johnson might not have known that cocaine is a controlled substance, he was put on notice of that fact when he was convicted, you know, a little while before of delivering cocaine. That was what I submitted to Judge Steele, and he thought that that was an acceptable basis, and that's how I also argued it to the jury.
There standing was, on its own with that, is that an acceptable reason to bring in a prior conviction, strictly on knowledge that whatever the prior conviction was involved, if it's the same one that's involved here, that's all you need?
When it's an element of the offense, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I mean, there would be other cases where you would commit some offense and particular knowledge
that
might not be an element.
Not something unrelated. I mean, a prior drug conviction is all you need in a current drug prosecution to bring in a prior conviction.
Well, I would say that when knowledge of the controlled substance is an element of the offense and that there is a prior, that prior becomes relevant to that element.
No matter what, even if it's pretty obvious the guy knows what crack is.
Well, it's relevant. It may be unduly prejudicial under
That's
other circumstances.
Is it is it unduly prejudicial when it's not even a contest? Of course, he knows what crack cocaine is. It's just
it may be unduly prejudicial.
In this case, after guns or something, I guess.
It may be unduly prejudicial in other circumstances where there's a mountain of evidence that the defendant knows that crack cocaine is a controlled substance. In most cases, though, we don't really spend a whole lot of time on that element. You just sort of tell the jury, well, everyone knows crack's a controlled substance, which is probably true, but it is still an element that we're required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So I could envision circumstances where that prior might not be properly admitted, but I'd submit in this case it was. And that,
well, given the testimony of Johnson's prior cocaine transactions with his brother and the informant, why was the evidence of the 2007 conviction necessary to establish knowledge?
Well, again, it's knowledge not that he knows what crack is, but knowledge that he knows it's a controlled substance. The argument is that you're dealing in something and that the fact that you went to court before and the court said you can't do this, you've been convicted of it, it puts you on notice that you know that it's a controlled substance.
Doesn't that sound like propensity to you?
No, Your Honor. Propensity would be that you are just inclined to engage in certain conduct, not that you are aware of a certain fact, that fact being that crack cocaine is something that is illegal, something that the law has proscribed.
Not in a legal sense, counsel, but to the average juror who hears about this prior conviction and now he's charged with the same thing, can you intellectually not understand or argue that that juror is not going to say, did it before, just doing the same thing again? That's what he does.
Well, of course, there is the potential for that chain of inferences, and that is why the government took the precautions that we took. We went through this issue before the trial. The government gave notice. The defendant filed a motion in limine. The government specifically said, you know, Judge Steele, the only way that we would offer this evidence would be if we did it under the following circumstances, those being that we give a limiting instruction, which was given, and also that we follow the process that was outlined in the case United States versus Perkins via judicial notice, not giving an actual paper copy of the conviction, but merely...
I think the concern that I have is that perhaps with some technical differences, let's assume that the government had a right to bring in that evidence. They had other evidence regarding his transactions with his brother. They have evidence of the informant. And the defense seems to suggest that many of those things were questionable, at least. The collection of these kinds of materials, do you not suggest that that might combine to deny the defendant that kind of fair hearing that he would be entitled to in the eyes of the jury?
Well, I would say no, Your Honor, for a number of reasons. First, I don't think it's fair for the defendant to complain about the cumulative effect of things that he didn't object to begin with. I mean, he had a chance to address some of those things before the trial, you know, because he had notice of them, and during the trial.
Have you never heard of plain error?
Yes, Your Honor, and I agree that that's the standard.
Right.
I agree. But just in terms of addressing the cumulative effect, the effect is it's lessened by all the precautions that we took, Your Honor. And that cumulative effect, I would say, whatever it weighs, is substantially outweighed by all of the other evidence. Again, I think that what's going on here is that we've sort of skipped over what the trial was really about, and 99% of the evidence was these recordings and the other testimony, and maybe 1% was these other things, and that the cumulative effect of the evidence not related to other things so greatly outweighs the cumulative effect of these other things that the result would have been the same. Those summarize my points on the evidentiary issues. The defendant also raised an issue as to his sentence. I would suggest that the sentence was correct. It was a guideline sentence. The judge specifically considered the arguments that the defendant's making in his brief, said, I take that into account, sentenced the defendant under the 3553A factors. I mean, primarily the defendant got the sentence he did because he had 13 prior convictions, five of which were career offender predicates.
I want to ask you about something else, because you say, you know, 1% of...
Well, don't hold me to that, Your Honor. That was a rhetorical device.
I'm going to hold you to every single thing you say in this courtroom.
I think that is a rhetorical device, Your Honor.
Do it. Well, wasn't the evidence that the police immediately recognized him by name, had a booking photo of him, of limited utility, shall we say, for the government's case, but with the potential, again, for significant prejudice? I mean, what did that establish for the prosecution that could not be adequately established with this 99% of the evidence?
Your Honor, I will readily concede that I wish Sergeant Cranmer had said we had a photo, not a booking photo. And frankly, if the defendant had objected to that during the trial, I didn't. The question he was answering was, were you able to identify the defendant or the person who you were going to be investigating? Not, did you have a booking photo or have you had prior contacts? He kind of answered that question the way he answered it. And had the defendant objected, I think it would have been proper to tell the jury, ignore the part about the booking photo. Just listen to the part about they knew who they were going to be.
That sure would be unringing a bell, wouldn't it? Isn't evidence that the police knew of Johnson likely to cause the jurors to believe that he's a repeat offender?
Well, that's one inference they could draw. There are a number. All they said was that they knew him from prior contacts. They didn't say we'd arrested him before, that he was a target of an investigation before, anything like that. They just said we knew him from prior contacts, and there are a number.
When the police say we know him of, you know, from prior contacts, would a normal jury think, oh, they must be related, or they went to high school together, or they date each other, or God only knows what? I mean, isn't the first thing that I mean, you're talking about zebras, and you know, I'm talking about horses.
Well, I think the more likely sort of innocent inference would be that this person has either been the victim of a crime before, has been a witness before. There are a number of things you can be, a number of other categories you can fall in other than sort of the defendant suspect category for people who deal with the police. And with nothing else, just saying we've had prior contacts, you know, I don't know if a juror would say, would be more inclined to believe that the defendant fell into one category or the other, but there's no evidence that it was any of the others. There are no other questions. I've made the points I wanted to make, and I just ask the court to affirm Johnson's conviction and his sentence. Thank you.
Mr. Boyce, how many minutes?
Four.
You've got 4 minutes.
A couple of points. The evidence that was presented at trial by Detective Cranmer was not just that we had prior contacts. The next thing out that he testified to was that we showed the confidential a booking photo, a mugshot. Now, every juror will relate a booking photo to a person being arrested, not innocent contact with law enforcement. Another thing that I would like to touch on, Your Honor, is the government's belief that any time a person is charged with a drug violation, the statute says that they have to prove that the defendant knowingly engaged in this transaction. If you take the government's approach, even if a person does not take the witness stand and their priors can't come in, the government seems to argue that because this is an element that I have to prove in every case, I should be able to introduce a prior conviction pursuant to 404B. And simply, Your Honor, that's not my reading or understanding of the law. The issue of knowledge intent has to be put forward. And that's in the United States v. Shackelford, that's one of the points from that case, that it's not just a situation where you have knowledge as a formal issue. It has to be raised by the defendant in order to justify something as prejudicial as a prior conviction, because it does lead the average person to say, he did it before, he did it again. And when you combine that with all the other inferences. And like I said before, each one by themselves may not be significant, but when you look at the prior conviction, the 15 prior drug sales, the officers already knew him. They presented a booking photo of the defendant. His own brother gets on the stand and says, I got some dope from him yesterday, the day before the controlled buy. And especially his brother testifying, that has no bearing on the case. It's not intrinsically intertwined, and it did nothing to add to the government's case. It simply painted the defendant as a prior crack cocaine user or seller. And
well, buying one yesterday is pretty current. I guess if you focus on the prior conviction, though, now, I don't know, you obviously weren't trial counsel.
No, Your Honor.
So the question is, did trial counsel make an effort to come up with a limiting instruction in his own words or what he wanted, or she, I don't know who, or was that the one the government, which isn't a very strong instruction, but it is a limiting instruction. Was there something more specific that should have been given or could have been? Or maybe they didn't want to bring it up. I don't know.
Well, I'm not sure what Ms. Schooley's thought process was, but you know, I believe there could have been a stronger limiting instruction to apprise the jury of how to treat this prior conviction if it does indeed come in.
That would have been up to the defense counsel to come up with one, wouldn't it?
That is true, Your Honor. That is true. That would have been an instruction that would have been submitted by the defense along with the government's, and would have been the issue of which one would have been used would have been decided at the jury instruction conference.
Mm-hmm. Was it argued before the jury with the one that they had saying with this limiting instruction? Was there any attempt at that? Or
I see my time
okay.
is up.
You
may
do,
I answer?
Just
in the closing argument or something, that's really what. In any way did they use it? Take the instruction and argue it. The limiting instruction to tell to disregard stuff? Or
no, Your Honor. In the transcripts, Ms. Schooley did not use the limiting instruction in her closing argument. It was read to the jury during the jury instruction. My time is up. If I may conclude, Your Honor.
Yes, of course.
We believe that the evidence introduced in this case rose to the level that it created an unfair propensity atmosphere and distracted the jury from the issues, no matter how strong they may be, but it distracted the jury from the issues and allowed them to possibly convict Mr. Johnson based on the fact that he has been involved in crack cocaine on prior occasions. And we would ask the court to reverse his conviction and remand it to the district court for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Holmes, you were court appointed.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you have the sincere thanks of the court for taking on this responsibility and doing it so very well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And of course, Mr. Boyce, you have our thanks as well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case will